For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
The Secret of the Growing Gold. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Haley Flagg. The Secret of the Growing Gold by Bram Stoker. When Margaret Delandre went to live at Brent's Rock, the whole neighborhood awoke to the pleasure of an entirely new scandal. Scandals in connection with either the Delandre family or the Brents of Brent's Rock were not few, and if the secret history of the county had been written in full, both names would have been found well represented. It is true that the status of each was so different that they might have belonged to different continents, or to different worlds, for the matter of that, for hitherto their orbits had never crossed. The Brents were accorded by the whole section of the county a unique social dominance, and had ever held themselves as high above the yeoman class to which Margaret Delandre belonged as a blue-blooded Spanish hidalgo outtops his peasant tenantry. The Delandres had an ancient record, and were proud of it in their way, as the Brents were of theirs. But the family had never risen above yeomanry, and although they had been once well-to-do in the good old times of foreign wars and protection, their fortunes had withered under the scorching of the free trade sun and the piping times of peace. They had, as the elder members used to assert, stuck to the land, with the result that they had taken root in it, body and soul. In fact, they, having chosen the life of vegetables, had flourished as vegetation does, blossomed and thrived in the good season, and suffered in the bad. Their holding, Dander's Croft, seemed to have been worked out, and to be typical of the family which had lived in it. The latter had declined, generation after generation, sending out now and again some abortive shoot of unsatisfied energy in the shape of a soldier or sailor who had worked his way to the minor grades of the services, and had there stopped, cut short either from unheeding gallantry in action, or from that destroying cause to men without breeding or youthful care, the recognition of a position above them which they feel unfitted to fill. So, little by little, the family dropped lower and lower, the men brooding and dissatisfied and drinking themselves into the grave, the women drudging at home or marrying beneath them, or worse. In process of time, all disappeared, leaving only two in the croft, Wickham Delandre and his sister Margaret. The man and woman seemed to have inherited in masculine and feminine form, respectively, the evil tendency of their race, sharing in common the principles, though manifesting them in different ways, of sullen passion, voluptuousness, and recklessness. The history of the Brents had been something similar, but showing the causes of decadence in their aristocratic and not their plebeian forms. They, too, had sent their shoots to the wars, but their positions had been different, and they had often attained honor, for without flaw they were gallant, and brave deeds were done by them before the selfish dissipation which marked them had sapped their vigor. The present head of the family, if family it could now be called when one remained of the direct line, was Geoffrey Brent. He was almost a type of worn-out race, manifesting in some ways its most brilliant qualities, and in others its utter degradation. He might be fairly compared with some of those antique Italian nobles whom the painters have preserved to us with their courage, their unscrupulousness, their refinement of lust and cruelty, the voluptuary actual with the fiendish potential. He was certainly handsome, with that dark, aquiline, commanding beauty which women so generally recognize as dominant. With men, he was distant and cold, but such a bearing never deters womankind. The inscrutable laws of sex are so arranged that even a timid woman is not afraid of a fierce and haughty man. And so it was that there was hardly a woman of any kind or degree who lived within view of Brent's Rock who did not cherish some form of secret admiration for the handsome wastrel. The category was a wide one, for Brent's Rock rose up steeply from the midst of a level region, and for a circuit of 100 miles, it lay on the horizon, with its high old towers and steep roofs, cutting the level edge of wood and hamlet and far-scattered mansions. So long as Geoffrey Brent confined his dissipations to London and Paris and Vienna, anywhere out of sight and sound of his home, opinion was silent. It is easy to listen to far-off echoes unmoved, and we can treat them with disbelief, or scorn, or disdain, or whatever attitude of coldness may suit our purpose. But when the scandal came close to home, it was another matter, and the feelings of independence and integrity which is in people of every community, which is not utterly spoiled, asserted itself and demanded that condemnation should be expressed. Still, there was a certain reticence in all, and no more notice was taken of the existing facts than was absolutely necessary. Margaret Delandre bore herself so fearlessly and so openly, she accepted her position as the justified companion of Geoffrey Brent so naturally, that people came to believe that she was secretly married to him, and therefore thought it wiser to hold their tongues, lest time should justify her, and also make her an active enemy. The one person who, by his interference, could have settled all doubts was debarred by circumstances from interfering in the matter. Wickham Delandre had quarrelled with his sister, or perhaps it was that she had quarrelled with him, and they were on terms not merely of armed neutrality, but of bitter hatred. The quarrel had been antecedent to Margaret going to Brent's Rock. She and Wickham had almost come to blows. There had certainly been threats on one side and on the other, and in the end Wickham, overcome with passion, had ordered his sister to leave his house. She had risen straight away, and without waiting to pack up even her own personal belongings, had walked out of the house. On the threshold she had paused for a moment to hurl a bitter threat at Wickham, that he would rue in shame and despair to the last hour of his life his act of that day. Some weeks had since passed, and it was understood in the neighbourhood that Margaret had gone to London, when she suddenly appeared driving out with Geoffrey Brent, and the entire neighborhood knew, before nightfall, that she had taken up her abode at the Rock. It was no subject of surprise that Brent had come back unexpectedly, for such was his usual custom. Even his own servants never knew when to expect him, for there was a private door, of which he alone had the key, by which he sometimes entered without anyone in the house being aware of his coming. This was his usual method of appearing after a long absence. Wickham Delandre was furious at the news. He vowed vengeance, and, to keep his mind level with his passion, drank deeper than ever. He tried several times to see his sister, but she contemptuously refused to meet him. He tried to have an interview with Brent, and was refused by him also. Then he tried to stop him in the road, but without avail, for Geoffrey was not a man to be stopped against his will. Several actual encounters took place between the two men, and many more were threatened and avoided. At last, Wickham Delandre settled down to a morose, vengeful acceptance of the situation. Neither Margaret nor Geoffrey was of a pacific temperament, and it was not long before there began to be quarrels between them. One thing would lead to another, and wine flowed freely at Brent's Rock. Now and again the quarrels would assume a bitter aspect, and threats would be exchanged in uncompromising language that fairly awed the listening servants. But such quarrels generally ended where domestic altercations do, in reconciliation, and in a mutual respect for the fighting qualities proportionate to their manifestation. Fighting for its own sake is found by a certain class of persons, all the world over, to be a matter of absorbing interest, and there is no reason to believe that domestic conditions minimize its potency. Geoffrey and Margaret made occasional absences from Brent's Rock, and on each of these occasions, Wickham Delandre also absented himself, but as he generally heard of the absence, too late to be of any service, he returned home each time in a more bitter and discontented frame of mind than before. At last there came a time when the absence from Brent's Rock became longer than before. Only a few days earlier there had been a quarrel, exceeding in bitterness anything which had gone before. But this, too, had been made up, and a trip on the continent had been mentioned before the servants. After a few days, Wickham Delandre also went away, and it was some weeks before he returned. It was noticed that he was full of some new importance, satisfaction, exaltation, they hardly knew how to call it. He went straight away to Brent's Rock and demanded to see Geoffrey Brent, and on being told that he had not yet returned, said, with a grim decision which the servants noted, "I shall come again. My news is solid. It can wait," and turned away. Week after week went by, and month after month, and then there came a rumor, certified later on, that an accident had occurred in the Zermatt Valley. Whilst crossing a dangerous pass, the carriage containing an English lady and the driver had fallen over a precipice, the gentleman of the party, Mr. Geoffrey Brent, having been fortunately saved as he had been walking up the hill to ease the horses. He gave information, and a search was made. The broken rail, the excoriated roadway, the marks where the horses had struggled on the decline before finally pitching over into the torrent, all told the sad tale. It was a wet season, and there had been much snow in the winter, so that the river was swollen beyond its usual volume, and the eddies of the stream were packed with ice. All search was made, and finally the wreck of the carriage and the body of one horse were found in an eddy of the river. Later, the body of the driver was found on the sandy, torrent-swept waste near Tosh, but the body of the lady, like that of the other horse, had quite disappeared and was, what was left of it by that time, whirling amongst the eddies of the Rhone on its way down to the Lake of Geneva. Wickham Delandre made all the inquiries possible, but could not find any trace of the missing woman. He found, however, in the books of the various hotels, the name of Mr. and Mrs. Geoffrey Brent, and he had a stone erected at Zermatt to his sister's memory, under her married name, and a tablet put up in the church at Breton, the parish in which both Brent's Rock and Dander's Croft were situated. There was a lapse of nearly a year after the excitement of the matter had worn away, and the whole neighborhood had gone on its accustomed way. Brent was still absent, and Delandre more drunken, more morose, and more revengeful than before. Then there was a new excitement. Brent's Rock was being made ready for a new mistress. It was officially announced by Geoffrey himself, in a letter to the vicar, that he had been married some months before to an Italian lady, and that they were then on their way home. Then a small army of workmen invaded the house, and hammer and plane sounded, and a general air of size and paint pervaded the atmosphere. One wing of the old house, the south, was entirely redone, and then the great body of the workmen departed, leaving only materials for the doing of the old hall when Geoffrey Brent should have returned, for he had directed that the decoration was only to be done under his own eyes. He had brought with him accurate drawings of a hall in the house of his bride's father, for he wished to reproduce for her the place to which she had been accustomed. As the molding had all to be redone, some scaffolding poles and boards were brought in and laid on one side of the great hall, and also a great wooden tank or box for mixing the lime, which was laid in bags beside it. When the new mistress of Brent's Rock arrived, the bells of the church rang out, and there was a general jubilation. She was a beautiful creature, full of the poetry and fire and passion of the South, and the few English words which she had learned were spoken in such a sweet and pretty broken way that she won the hearts of the people almost as much by the music of her voice as by the melting beauty of her dark eyes. Geoffrey Brent seemed more happy than he had ever before appeared, but there was a dark, anxious look on his face that was new to those who knew him of old, and he started at times as though at some noise that was unheard by others. And so months passed, and the whisper grew that at last Brent's Rock was to have an heir. Geoffrey was very tender to his wife, and the new bond between them seemed to soften him. He took more interest in his tenants and their needs than he had ever done, and works of charity on his part as well as on his sweet young wife's were not lacking. He seemed to have set all his hopes on the child that was coming, and as he looked deeper into the future, the dark shadow that had come over his face seemed to die gradually away. All the time, Wickham Delandre nursed his revenge. Deep in his heart had grown up a purpose of vengeance, which only waited an opportunity to crystallize and take a definite shape. His vague idea was somehow centered in the wife of Brent, for he knew that he could strike him best through those he loved, and the coming time seemed to hold in its womb the opportunity for which he longed. One night he sat alone in the living room of his house. It had once been a handsome room in its way, but time and neglect had done their work, and it was now little better than a ruin, without dignity or picturesqueness of any kind. He had been drinking heavily for some time, and was more than half stupefied. He thought he heard a noise, as of someone at the door, and looked up. Then he called half savagely to come in, but there was no response. With a muttered blasphemy, he renewed his potations. Presently he forgot all around him, sank into a daze, but suddenly awoke, to see, standing before him, someone, or something, like a battered, ghostly edition of his sister. For a few moments there came upon him a sort of fear. The woman before him, with distorted features and burning eyes, seemed hardly human, and the only thing that seemed a reality of his sister, as she had been, was her wealth of golden hair, and this was now streaked with gray. She eyed her brother with a long, cold stare, and he, too, as he looked and began to realize the actuality of her presence, found the hatred of her which he had had once again surging up in his heart. All the brooding passion of the past year seemed to find a voice at once as he asked her, "Why are you here? You're dead and buried." "I am here, Wickham Delandre, for no love of you, but because I hate another even more than I do you." A great passion blazed in her eyes. "Him?" he asked in so fierce a whisper that even the woman was for an instant startled till she regained her calm. "Yes, him," she answered. "But make no mistake, my revenge is my own, and I merely use you to help me to it." Wickham asked suddenly, "Did he marry you?" The woman's distorted face broadened out in a ghastly attempt at a smile. It was a hideous mockery, for the broken features and seamed scars took strange shapes and strange colors, and queer lines of white showed out as the straining muscles pressed on the old cicatrices. "So you would like to know. It would please your pride to feel that your sister was truly married. Well, you shall not know. That was my revenge on you, and I do not mean to change it by a hair's breadth. I have come here tonight simply to let you know that I am alive, so that if any violence be done me where I am going, there may be a witness." "Where are you going?" demanded her brother. "That is my affair, and I have not the least intention of letting you know." Wickham stood up, but the drink was on him, and he reeled and fell. As he lay on the floor, he announced his intention of following his sister, and with an outburst of splenetic humor, told her that he would follow her through the darkness by the light of her hair and of her beauty. At this, she turned on him, and said that there were others beside him that would rue her hair and her beauty, too. "As he will," she hissed, "for the hair remains, though the beauty be gone. When he withdrew the linchpin and sent us over the precipice into the torrent, he had little thought of my beauty. Perhaps his beauty would be scarred like mine, were he whirled, as I was, amongst the rocks of the Visp, and frozen on the ice-pack in the drift of the river. But let him beware. His time is coming." And with a fierce gesture, she flung open the door and passed out into the night. Later on that night, Mrs. Brent, who was but half asleep, became suddenly awake and spoke to her husband.
"Geoffrey, was not that the click of a lock somewhere below our window?"
But Geoffrey, though she thought that he too had started at the noise, seemed sound asleep and breathed heavily. Again Mrs. Brent dozed, but this time awoke to the fact that her husband had arisen and was partially dressed. He was deadly pale, and when the light of the lamp which he had in his hand fell on his face, she was frightened at the look in his eyes.
"What is it, Geoffrey? What dost thou?" she asked.
"Hush, little one," he answered, in a strange, hoarse voice. "Go to sleep. I am restless, and wish to finish some work I left undone."
"Bring it here, my husband," she said. "I am lonely, and I fear when thou art away."
For reply, he merely kissed her and went out, closing the door behind him. She lay awake for a while, and then nature asserted itself, and she slept. Suddenly, she started broad awake, with the memory in her ears of a smothered cry from somewhere not far off. She jumped up and ran to the door and listened, but there was no sound. She grew alarmed for her husband, and called out, "Geoffrey! Geoffrey!" After a few moments, the door of the great hall opened, and Geoffrey appeared at it, but without his lamp.
"Hush!" he said in a sort of whisper, and his voice was harsh and stern. "Hush! Get to bed! I am working and must not be disturbed. Go to sleep and do not wake the house!"
With a chill in her heart, for the harshness in her husband's voice was new to her, she crept back to bed and lay there trembling, too frightened to cry, and listened to every sound. There was a long pause of silence, and then the sound of some iron implement striking muffled blows. Then there came a clang of heavy stone falling, followed by a muffled curse. Then a dragging sound, and then more noise of stone on stone. She lay all the while in an agony of fear, and her heart beat dreadfully. She heard a curious sort of scraping sound, and then there was silence. Presently, the door opened gently, and Geoffrey appeared. His wife pretended to be asleep, but through her eyelashes she saw him wash from his hands something white that looked like lime. In the morning he made no allusion to the previous night, and she was afraid to ask any question. From that day there seemed some shadow over Geoffrey Brent. He neither ate nor slept as he had been accustomed, and his former habit of turning suddenly as though someone were speaking from behind him revived. The old hall seemed to have some kind of fascination for him. He used to go there many times in the day,
but grew impatient if anyone, even his wife, entered it. When the builder's foreman came to inquire about continuing his work, Geoffrey was out driving. The man went into the hall, and when Geoffrey returned, the servant told him of his arrival and where he was. With a frightful oath, he pushed the servant aside and hurried up to the old hall. The workman met him almost at the door, and as Geoffrey burst into the room, he ran against him. The man apologized.
"Beg pardon, sir, but I was just going out to make some inquiries. I directed 12 sacks of lime to be sent here, but I see there are only 10.
"Curse the 10 sacks and the 12, too," was the ungracious and incomprehensible rejoinder. The workman looked surprised, and tried to turn the conversation.
"I see, sir, there's a little matter which our people must have done, but the governor will, of course, see it set right at his own cost."
"What do you mean?"
"That ere hearthstone, sir. Some idiot must have put a scaffold pole on it and cracked it right down the middle, and it's thick enough you'd think to stand anything."
Geoffrey was silent for quite a minute, and then said in a constrained voice, and with much gentler manner,
"Tell your people that I am not going on with the work in the hall at present. I want to leave it as it is for a while longer."
"All right, sir. I'll send up a few of our chaps to take away these poles and lime bags and tidy the place up a bit."
"No, no," said Geoffrey. "Leave them where they are. I shall send and tell you when you are to get on with the work."
So the foreman went away, and his comment to his master was,
"I'd send in the bill, sir, for the work already done. 'Pears to me that money's a little shaky in that quarter."
Once or twice, Delandre tried to stop Brent on the road, and at last, finding that he could not attain his object, rode after the carriage, calling out,
"What has become of my sister, your wife?"
Geoffrey lashed his horses into a gallop, and the other, seeing from his white face and from his wife's collapse almost into a faint that his object was attained, rode away with a scowl and a laugh. That night, when Geoffrey went into the hall, he passed over to the great fireplace, and all at once started back with a smothered cry. Then, with an effort, he pulled himself together and went away, returning with a light. He bent down over the broken hearthstone to see if the moonlight falling through the storied window had in any way deceived him. Then, with a groan of anguish, he sank to his knees. There, sure enough, through the crack in the broken stone, were protruding a multitude of threads of golden hair, just tinged with grey. He was disturbed by a noise at the door, and looking round, saw his wife standing in the doorway. In the desperation of the moment, he took action to prevent discovery, and lighting a match at the table, stooped down and burned away the hair that rose through the broken stone. Then, rising as nonchalantly as he could, he pretended surprise at seeing his wife beside him. For the next week, he lived in an agony, for, whether by accident or design, he could not find himself alone in the hall for any length of time. At each visit, the hair had grown afresh through the crack, and he had to watch it carefully, lest his terrible secret should be discovered. He tried to find a receptacle for the body of the murdered woman outside the house, but someone always interrupted him, and once, when he was coming out of the private doorway, he was met by his wife, who began to question him about it, and manifested surprise that she should not have before noticed the key which he now reluctantly showed her. Geoffrey dearly and passionately loved his wife, so that any possibility of her discovering his dread secrets, or even of doubting him, filled him with anguish, and after a couple of days had passed, he could not help coming to the conclusion that, at least, she suspected something. That very evening, she came into the hall after her drive and found him there, sitting moodily by the deserted fireplace. She spoke to him directly.
"Geoffrey, I have been spoken to by that fellow Delandre, and he says horrible things. He tells me that a week ago his sister returned to his house, the wreck and ruin of her former self, with only her golden hair as of old, and announced some fell intention. He asked me where she is, and oh, Geoffrey, she is dead, she is dead! So how can she have returned? I am in dread, and I know not where to turn."
For answer, Geoffrey burst into a torrent of blasphemy which made her shudder. He cursed Delandre and his sister and all their kind, and in especial he hurled curse after curse on her golden hair.
"Oh, hush, hush," she said,
and was then silent, for she feared her husband when she saw the evil effect of his humor. Geoffrey, in the torrent of his anger, stood up and moved away from the hearth, but suddenly stopped as he saw a new look of terror in his wife's eyes. He followed their glance, and then he too shuddered, for there, on the broken hearthstone, lay a golden streak, as the point of the hair rose through the crack.
"Look! Look!" she shrieked. "It is some ghost of the dead! Come away! Come away!"
and seizing her husband by the wrist with the frenzy of madness, she pulled him from the room. That night she was in a raging fever. The doctor of the district attended her at once, and special aid was telegraphed for to London. Geoffrey was in despair, and in his anguish at the danger of his young wife almost forgot his own crime and its consequences. In the evening, the doctor had to leave to attend to others, but he left Geoffrey in charge of his wife. His last words were, "Remember, you must humour her till I come in the morning, or till some other doctor has her case in hand. What you have to dread is another attack of emotion. See that she is kept warm. Nothing more can be done." Late in the evening, when the rest of the household had retired, Geoffrey's wife got up from her bed and called to her husband.
"Come," she said, "come to the old hall. I know where the gold comes from. I want to see it grow."
Geoffrey would fain have stopped her, but he feared for her life or reason on the one hand, and lest in a paroxysm she should shriek out her terrible suspicion, and seeing that it was useless to try and prevent her, wrapped a warm rug about her and went with her to the old hall. When they entered, she turned and shut the door and locked it.
"We want no strangers amongst us three tonight," she whispered with a wan smile.
"We three? Nay, but we are two," said Geoffrey with a shudder. He feared to say more.
"Sit here," said his wife as she put out the light. "Sit here by the hearth and watch the gold growing. The silver moonlight is jealous. See, it steals along the floor towards the gold. Our gold."
Geoffrey looked with growing horror and saw that during the hours that had passed, the golden hair had protruded further through the broken hearthstone. He tried to hide it by placing his feet over the broken place, and his wife, drawing her chair beside him, leant over and laid her head on his shoulder.
"Now do not stir, dear," she said. "Let us sit still and watch. We shall find the secret of the growing gold."
He passed his arm round her and sat silent, and as the moonlight stole along the floor, she sank to sleep. He feared to wake her, and so sat silent and miserable as the hours stole away. Before his horror-struck eyes, the golden hair from the broken stone grew and grew, and as it increased, so his heart got colder and colder. Till at last he had not power to stir, and sat with his eyes full of terror, watching his doom. In the morning, when the London doctor came, neither Geoffrey nor his wife could be found. Search was made in all the rooms, but without avail. As a last resource, the great door of the old hall was broken open, and those who entered saw a grim and sorry sight. There, by the deserted hearth, Geoffrey Brent and his young wife sat cold and white and dead. Her face was peaceful, and her eyes were closed in sleep, but his face was a sight that made all who saw it shudder, for there was on it a look of unutterable horror. The eyes were open and stared glassily at his feet, which were twined with tresses of golden hair streaked with grey, which came through the broken hearthstone. End of The Secret of the Growing Gold. Recording by Haley Flagg of Texas.
The Gypsy Prophecy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Kate McKenzie. The Gypsy Prophecy by Bram Stoker.
"I really think," said the doctor, "that, at any rate, one of us should go and try whether or not the thing is an imposture."
"Good," said Considine. "After dinner, we will take our cigars and stroll over to the camp."
Accordingly, when the dinner was over and the La Tour finished, Joshua Considine and his friend, Dr. Burley, went over to the east side of the moor, where the gypsy encampment lay. As they were leaving, Mary Considine, who had walked as far at the end of the garden where it opened into the laneway, called after her husband. "Mind, Joshua, you're to give them a fair chance, but don't give them any clue to a fortune, and don't you get flirting with any of the gypsy maidens, and take care to keep Gerald out of harm." For answer, Considine held up his hand, as if taking a stage oath, and whistled the air of the old song, "The Gypsy Countess." Gerald joined in the strain, and then, breaking into merry laughter, the two men passed along the laneway to the common, turning now and then to wave their hands to Mary, who leaned over the gate, in the twilight, looking after them. It was a lovely evening in the summer. The very air was full of rest and quiet happiness, as though an outward type of the peacefulness and joy which made a heaven of the home of the young married folk. Considine's life had not been an eventful one. The only disturbing element which he had ever known was in his wooing of Mary Winston, and the long-continued objection of her ambitious parents, who expected a brilliant match for their only daughter. When Mr. and Mrs. Winston had discovered the attachment of the young barrister, they had tried to keep the young people apart by sending their daughter away for a long round of visits, having made her promise not to correspond with her lover during her absence. Love, however, had stood the test. Neither absence nor neglect seemed to cool the passion of the young man, and jealousy seemed a thing unknown to his sanguine nature. So, after a long period of waiting, the parents had given in, and the young folk were married. They had been living in the cottage a few months, and were just beginning to feel at home. Gerald Burleigh, Joshua's old college chum, and himself sometime victim of Mary's beauty, had arrived a week before to stay with them for as long a time as he could tear himself away from his work in London. When her husband had quite disappeared, Mary went into the house and, sitting down at the piano, gave an hour to Mendelssohn. It was but a short walk across the common, and before the cigars required renewing, the two men had reached the gypsy camp. The place was as picturesque as gypsy camps, when in villages and when business is good, usually are. There were some few persons round the fire, investing their money in prophecy, and a large number of others, poorer or more parsimonious, who stayed just outside the bounds, but near enough to see all that went on. As the two gentlemen approached, the villagers, who knew Joshua, made way a little, and a pretty keen-eyed gypsy girl tripped up and asked to tell their fortunes. Joshua held out his hand, but the girl, without seeming to see it, stared at his face in a very odd manner. Gerald nudged him. "You must cross her hand with silver," he said. "It is one of the most important parts of the mystery." Joshua took from his pocket a half-crown and held it out to her, but, without looking at it, she answered, "You have to cross the gypsy's hand with gold." Gerald laughed. "You are at a premium as a subject," he said. Joshua was of the kind of man, the universal kind, who can tolerate being stared at by a pretty girl. So, with some little deliberation, he answered, "All right, here you are, my pretty girl, but you must give me a real good fortune for it." And he handed her a half-sovereign, which she took, saying, "It is not for me to give good fortune or bad, but only to read what the stars have said." She took his right hand and turned it palm upward, but the instant her eyes met it, she dropped it, as though it had been red-hot, and, with a startled look, glided swiftly away. Lifting the curtain of the large tent, which occupied the centre of the camp, she disappeared within. "Sold again?" said the cynical Gerald. Joshua stood a little amazed and not altogether satisfied. They both watched the large tent. In a few moments there emerged from the opening not the young girl, but a stately-looking woman of middle age and commanding presence. The instant she appeared the whole camp seemed to stand still. The clamour of tongues, the laughter and noise of the work were, for a second or two, arrested, and every man or woman who sat or crouched or lay stood up and faced the imperial-looking gypsy. "The Queen, of course," murmured Gerald. "We are in luck tonight." The gypsy queen threw a searching glance around the camp, and then, without hesitating an instant, came straight over and stood before Joshua. "Hold out your hand," she said in a commanding tone. Again Gerald spoke sotto voce. "I have not been spoken to in that way since I was at school. Your hand must be crossed with gold." 100% at this game," whispered Gerald, as Joshua laid another half-sovereign on his upturned palm. The gypsy looked at the hand with knitted brows, then suddenly looking up into his face said, "Have you a strong will? Have you a true heart that can be brave for one you love?" "I hope so, but I am afraid I have not vanity enough to say yes." "Then I will answer for you, for I read resolution in your face, resolution desperate and determined if need be. You have a wife you love?" "Yes," emphatically. "Then leave her at once. Never see her face again. Go from her now, while love is fresh and your heart is free from wicked intent. Go quick, go far, and never see her face again." Joshua drew away his hand quickly and said, "Thank you," stiffly but sarcastically, as he began to move away. "I say," said Gerald, "you're not going like that, old man. No use in being indignant with the stars or their prophet.
and, moreover, your sovereign. What of it? At least, hear the matter out.
Silence, ribald, commanded the queen. You know not what you do. Let him go, and go ignorant, if he will not be warned.
Joshua immediately turned back.
At all events, we will see this thing out, he said. Now, madam, you have given me advice, but I paid for a fortune. Be warned, said the gypsy. The stars have been silent for long. Let the mystery still wrap them round. My dear madam, I do not get within touch of a mystery every day, and I prefer for my money knowledge rather than ignorance. I can get the latter commodity for nothing when I want any of it.
Gerald echoed the sentiment.
As for me, I have a large and unsaleable stock on hand.
The gypsy queen eyed the two men sternly and then said,
As you wish. You have chosen for yourself, and have met warning with scorn, and appeal with levity. On your own heads be the doom. Amen, said Gerald.
With an imperious gesture, the queen took Joshua's hand again, and began to tell his fortune.
I see here the flowing of blood. It will flow before long. It is running in my sight. It flows through the broken circle of a severed ring.
Go on, said Joshua, smiling. Gerald was silent.
Must I speak plainer?
Certainly. We commonplace mortals want something definite. The stars are a long way off, and their words get somewhat dulled in the message. The gypsy shuddered, and then spoke impressively.
This is the hand of a murderer, the murderer of his wife.
She dropped the hand and turned away. Joshua laughed.
Do you know, said he, I think if I were you, I should prophesy some jurisprudence into my system. For instance, you say, this hand is the hand of a murderer.
Well, whatever it may be in the future, or potentially,
it is at present not one. You ought to give your prophecy in such terms as, the hand which will be a murderer's, or rather, the hand of one who will be the murderer of his wife. The stars are not really good on technical questions.
The gypsy made no reply of any kind, but, with drooping head and despondent mien, walked slowly to her tent and, lifting the curtain, disappeared. Without speaking, the two men turned homewards and walked across the moor. Presently, after some little hesitation, Gerald spoke.
Of course, old man, this is all a joke. A ghastly one, but still a joke. But would it not be well to keep it to ourselves?
How do you mean?
Well, not tell your wife. It might alarm her.
Alarm her?
My dear Gerald,
what are you thinking of?
Why, she would not be alarmed or afraid of me if all the gypsies that ever didn't come from Bohemia agreed that I was to murder her, or even to have a hard thought of her, whilst so long as she was saying Jack Robinson.
Gerald remonstrated, Old fellow, women are superstitious, far more than we men are, and also they are blessed or cursed, with a nervous system to which we are strangers. I see too much of it in my work not to realise it. Take my advice. And do not let her know, or you will frighten her.
Joshua's lips unconsciously hardened as he answered, My dear fellow, I would not have a secret from my wife.
Why, it would be the beginning of a new order of things between us.
We have no secrets from each other. If we ever have, then you may begin to look out for something odd between us.
Still, said Gerald, at the risk of unwelcome interference, I say again, be warned in time.
The gypsy's very words, said Joshua. You and she seemed quite of one accord.
Tell me, old man, is this a put-up thing? You told me of the gypsy camp. Did you arrange it all with Her Majesty?
This was said with an air of bantering earnestness.
Gerald assured him that he only heard of the camp that morning, but he made fun of every answer of his friend, and in the process of this raillery, the time passed, and they entered the cottage. Mary was sitting at the piano, but not playing. The dim twilight had waked some very tender feelings in her breast, and her eyes were full of gentle tears.
When the men came in, she stole over to her husband's side and kissed him. Joshua struck a tragic attitude.
"Mary," he said in a deep voice, "before you approach me, listen to the words of fate. The stars have spoken, and the doom is sealed."
"What is it, dear? Tell me the fortune, but do not frighten me."
"Not at all, my dear. But there is a truth which it is well that you should know. Nay, it is necessary so that all your arrangements can be made beforehand, and everything be decently done and in order."
"Go on, dear. I am listening."
"Mary Considine, your effigy may yet be seen at Madame Tussaud's. The Duris imprudent stars have announced their fell tidings that this hand is red with blood. Your blood."
"Mary! Mary! My God!" He sprang forward, but too late to catch her as she fell, fainting on the floor.
"I told you," said Gerald. "You don't know them as well as I do."
After a little while, Mary recovered from her swoon, but only to fall into strong hysterics, in which she laughed and wept and raved and cried, "Keep him from me, Joshua, my husband!" and many other words of entreaty and of fear. Joshua Considine was in a state of mind bordering on agony, and when at last Mary became calm, he knelt by her and kissed her feet and hands and hair, and called her all the sweet names and said all the tender things his lips could frame. All that night he sat by her bedside and held her hand. Far through the night and up to the early morning she kept waking from sleep and crying out as if in fear, till she was comforted by the consciousness that her husband was watching beside her. Breakfast was late the next morning, but during it Joshua received a telegram which required him to drive over to Withering, nearly 20 miles. He was loath to go, but Mary would not hear of his remaining, and so before noon he drove off in his dog-cart alone. When he was gone, Mary retired to her room. She did not appear at lunch, but when afternoon tea was served on the lawn under the great weeping willow, she came to join her guest. She was looking quite recovered from her illness of the evening before. After some casual remarks, she said to Gerald, "Of course it was very silly about last night, but I could not help feeling frightened. Indeed, I would feel so still if I let myself think of it. But after all, these people may only imagine things, and I have got a test that can hardly fail to show that the prediction is false. If indeed it be false," she added sadly.
"What is your plan?" asked Gerald.
"I shall go myself to the gypsy camp and have my fortune told by the Queen."
"Capital. May I go with you?"
"Oh no, that would spoil it. She might know you and guess at me, and suit her utterance accordingly. I shall go alone this afternoon." When the afternoon was gone, Mary Considine took her way to the gypsy encampment. Gerald went with her as far as the near edge of the common, and returned alone. Half an hour had hardly elapsed when Mary entered the drawing-room, where he lay on a sofa reading. She was ghastly pale, and was in a state of extreme excitement. Hardly had she passed over the threshold when she collapsed and sank moaning on the carpet. Gerald rushed to aid her, but by a great effort she controlled herself and motioned him to be silent. He waited, and his ready attention to her wish seemed to be her best help, for, in a few minutes, she had somewhat recovered, and was able to tell him what had passed. "When I got to the camp," she said, "there did not seem to be a soul about. I went into the centre and stood there. Suddenly a tall woman stood beside me.
'Something told me I was wanted,' she said.
I held out my hand and laid a piece of silver on it. She took from her neck a small golden trinket and laid it there also, and then, seizing the two, threw them into the stream that ran by. Then she took my hand in hers and spoke, 'Naught but blood in this guilty place,' and turned away. I caught hold of her and asked her to tell me more. After some hesitation, she said, 'Alas, alas! I see you lying at your husband's feet, and his hands are red with blood.'" Gerald did not feel at all at ease, and tried to laugh it off.
"Surely," he said, "this woman has a craze about murder."
"Do not laugh," said Mary, "I cannot bear it." And then, as if with a sudden impulse, she left the room. Not long after, Joshua returned, bright and cheery, and as hungry as a hunter after his long drive. His presence cheered his wife, who seemed much brighter, but she did not mention the episode of the visit to the gypsy camp, so Gerald did not mention it either. As if by tacit consent, the subject was not alluded to during the evening, but there was a strange, settled look on Mary's face, which Gerald could not but observe. In the morning, Joshua came down to breakfast later than usual. Mary had been up and about the house from an early hour, but as the time drew on, she seemed to get a little nervous, and now and again threw around an anxious look. Gerald could not help noticing that none of those at breakfast could get on satisfactorily with their food. It was not altogether that the chops were tough, but that the knives were all so blunt. Being a guest, he, of course, made no sign, but presently saw Joshua draw his thumb across the edge of his knife in an unconscious sort of way. At the action, Mary turned pale and almost fainted. After breakfast, they all went out on the lawn. Mary was making up a bouquet and said to her husband, "Get me a few of the tea roses, dear." Joshua pulled down a cluster from the front of the house. The stem bent, but was too tough to break. He put his hand in his pocket to get his knife, but in vain. "Lend me your knife, Gerald," he said, but Gerald had not got one, so he went into the breakfast room and took one from the table. He came out feeling its edge and grumbling, "What on earth has happened to all the knives? The edges seem all ground off." Mary turned away hurriedly and entered the house. Joshua tried to sever the stalk with the blunt knife as country cooks sever the necks of fowl, as schoolboys cut twine. With a little effort, he finished the task. The cluster of roses grew thick, so he determined to gather a great bunch. He could not find a single sharp knife in the sideboard where the cutlery was kept, so he called Mary, and when she came, told her the state of things. She looked so agitated and so miserable that he could not help knowing the truth, and, as if astounded and hurt, asked her, "Do you mean to say that you have done it?" She broke in, "Oh, Joshua, I was so afraid!" He paused, and a set, white look came over his face. "Mary," said he, "is this all the trust you have in me? I would not have believed it." "Oh, Joshua, Joshua," she cried entreatingly, "forgive me," and wept bitterly. Joshua thought a moment and then said, "I see how it is. We shall better end this or we shall all go mad." He ran into the drawing room. "Where are you going?" almost screamed Mary. Gerald saw what he meant, that he would not be tied to blunt instruments by the force of a superstition, and was not surprised when he saw him come out through the French window, bearing in his hand a large Gurkha knife, which usually lay on the centre table, and which his brother had sent him from northern India. It was one of those great hunting knives which worked such havoc at close quarters with the enemies of the loyal Gurkhas during the mutiny, of great weight, but so evenly balanced in the hand as to seem light, and with an edge like a razor. With one of these knives a Gurkha can cut a sheep in two. When Mary saw him come out of the room with the weapon in his hand, she screamed in an agony of fright, and the hysterics of last night were promptly renewed. Joshua ran toward her, and, seeing her falling, threw down the knife and tried to catch her. However, he was just a second too late, and the two men cried out in horror simultaneously as they saw her fall upon the naked blade. When Gerald rushed over, he found that in falling her left hand had struck the blade, which lay partly upwards on the grass. Some of the small veins were cut through, and the blood gushed freely from the wound. As he was tying it up, he pointed out to Joshua that the wedding ring was severed by the steel. They carried her fainting to the house. When, after a while, she came out, with her arm in a sling, she was peaceful in her mind, and happy. She said to her husband, "The gypsy was wonderfully near the truth. Too near for the real thing ever to occur now, dear." Joshua bent over and kissed the wounded hand. End of The Gypsy Prophecy. Read by Kate McKenzie.
The Coming of Abel Behenna. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Kate McKenzie. The Coming of Abel Behenna by Bram Stoker. The little Cornish port of Pencastle was bright in the early April, when the sun had seemingly come out to stay after a long and bitter winter. Boldly and blackly the rocks stood out against a background of shaded blue, where the sky, fading into mist, met the far horizon. The sea was of true Cornish hue, sapphire, save where it became deep emerald green in the fathomless depths under the cliffs, where the seal caves opened their grim jaws. On the slopes, the grass was parched and brown. The spikes of furze bushes were ashy grey, but the golden yellow of their flowers streamed along the hillside, dipping out in lines as the rock cropped up, and lessening into patches and dots, till finally it died away altogether, where the sea wind swept around the jutting cliffs, and cut short the vegetation as though with an ever-working aerial shear. The whole hillside, with its body of brown and flashes of yellow, was just like a colossal yellow hammer. The little harbour opened from the sea between towering cliffs, and behind a lonely rock, pierced with many caves and blowholes through which the sea in storm time sent its thunderous voice, together with a fountain of drifting spume. Hence, it wound westwards in a serpentine course, guarded at its entrance by two little curving piers to left and right. These were roughly built of dark slates, placed endways and held together with great beams browned with iron bands. Thence it flowed up the rocky bed of the stream, whose winter torrents had of old cut out its way amongst the hills. This stream was deep at first, with here and there where it widened patches of broken rock exposed at low water, full of holes where crabs and lobsters were to be found at the ebb of the tide. From amongst the rocks rose steady posts, used for warping in the little coasting vessels which frequented the port. Higher up, the stream still flowed deeply, for the tide ran far inland, but always calmly, for all the force of the wildest storm was broken below. Some quarter mile inland, the stream was deep at high water, but at low tide there were at each side patches of the same broken rock as lower down, through the chinks of which the sweet water of the natural stream tickled and murmured after the tide had ebbed away. Here, too, rose mooring posts for the fishermen's boats. At either side of the river was a row of cottages down almost on the level of high tide. They were pretty cottages, strongly and snugly built, with trim narrow gardens in front, full of old-fashioned plants, flowering currants, coloured primroses, wallflower and stonecrop. Over the fronts of many of them climbed clematis and wisteria. The window sides and doorposts of all were as white as snow, and the little pathway to each was paved with light-coloured stones. At some of the doors were tiny porches, whilst at others were rustic seats cut from tree trunks or from old barrels. In nearly every case the window ledges were filled with boxes or pots of flowers or foliage plants. Two men lived in cottages exactly opposite each other across the stream. Two men, both young, both good-looking, both prosperous, and who had been companions and rivals from their boyhood. Abel Behenna was dark, with a gypsy darkness which the Phoenician mining wanderers left in their track. Eric Samson, which the local antiquarian said was a corruption of Sagamanson, was fair, which the ruddy hue which marked the path of the now wild Norsemen. These two seemed to have singled out each other from the very beginning to work and strive together, to fight for each other, and to stand back to back in all endeavours. They had now put the coping stone on their temple of unity by falling in love with the same girl. Sarah Trefusis was certainly the prettiest girl in Pencastle, and there was many a young man who would gladly have tried his fortune with her, but that there were two to contend against, and each of these the strongest and most resolute man in the port, except the other. The average young man thought that this was very hard, and on account of it bore no goodwill to either of the three principals, whilst the average young woman who had, lest worse should befall, to put up with the grumbling of her sweetheart, and the sense of being only second best which it implied, did not either, be sure, regard Sarah with friendly eye. Thus it came, in the course of a year or so, for rustic courtship is a slow process, that the two men and woman found themselves thrown much together. They were all satisfied, so it did not matter, and Sarah, who was vain and something frivolous, took care to have her revenge on both men and women in a quiet way. when a young woman in her walking out can only boast one not quite satisfied young man, it is no particular pleasure for her to see her escort cast sheep's eyes at a better-looking girl supported by two devoted swains. At length, there came a time which Sarah dreaded, and which she had tried to keep distant. The time when she had to make a choice between the two men. She liked them both, and, indeed, either of them might have satisfied the ideas of even a more exacting girl. But her mind was so constituted that she thought more of what she might lose than of what she might gain. And whenever she thought she had made up her mind, she became instantly assailed with doubts as to the wisdom of her choice. Always the man whom she had presumably lost became endowed afresh with a newer and more bountiful crop of advantages than had ever arisen from the possibility of his acceptance. She promised each man that on her birthday she would give him his answer, and that day, the 11th of April, had now arrived. The promises had been given singly and confidentially, but each was given to a man who was not likely to forget. Early in the morning she found both men hovering round her door. Neither had taken the other into his confidence, and each was simply seeking an early opportunity of getting his answer and advancing his suit if necessary. Damon, as a rule, does not take Pythias with him when making a proposal, and in the heart of each man his own affairs had a claim far above any requirements of friendship. So, throughout the day, they kept seeing each other out. The position was doubtless somewhat embarrassing to Sarah, and though the satisfaction of her vanity that she should be thus adored was very pleasing, yet there were moments when she was annoyed with both men for being so persistent. Her only consolation at such moments was that she saw, through the elaborate smiles of the other girls when in passing they noticed her door thus doubly guarded, the jealousy which filled their hearts. Sarah's mother was a person of commonplace and sordid ideas, and, seeing all along the state of affairs, her one intention, persistently expressed to her daughter in the plainest words, was to so arrange matters that Sarah should get all that was possible out of both men. With this purpose, she had cunningly kept herself as far as possible in the background in the matter of her daughter's wooings, and watched in silence. At first Sarah had been indignant with her for her sordid views, but, as usual, her weak nature gave way before persistence, and she had now got to the stage of acceptance. She was not surprised when her mother whispered to her in the little yard behind the house, "Go up the hillside for a while. I want to talk to these two. They're both red-hot for you, and now's the time to get things fixed." Sarah began her feeble remonstrance, but her mother cut her short. "I tell you, girl, that my mind is made up. Both these men want you, and only one can have you, but before you choose, it'll be so arranged that you'll have all that both have got. Don't argue, child. Go up the hillside, and when you come back, I'll have it fixed. I see a way quite easy." So Sarah went up the hillside through the narrow paths between the golden firs, and Mrs. Trefusis joined the two men in the living room of the little house. She opened the tack with a desperate courage which is in all mothers when they think for their children, howsoever mean the thoughts may be. "You two men, you're both in love with my Sarah!" Her bashful silence gave consent to the barefaced proposition. She went on, "Neither of you has much." Again they tacitly acquiesced in the soft impeachment. "I don't know that either of you could keep a wife." Though neither said a word, their looks and bearing expressed distinct dissent. Mrs. Trefusis went on, "But if you'd put what you both have together, you'd make a comfortable home for one of you, and Sarah." She eyed the men keenly, with her cunning eyes half shut as she spoke. Then, satisfied from her scrutiny that the idea was accepted, she went on quickly as if to prevent argument. "The girl likes you both, and mayhap it's hard for her to choose. Why don't you toss up for her? First, put your money together. You've each got a bit put by, I know. Let the lucky man take the lot and trade with it a bit, and then come home and marry her. Neither of you's afraid, I suppose?" and neither of you'll say that you won't do that much for the girl that you both say you love." Abel broke the silence. "It don't seem a square thing to toss for the girl. She wouldn't like it herself, and it doesn't seem respectful-like to her," Eric interrupted. He was conscious that his chance was not so good as Abel's in case Sarah should wish to choose between them. "You're afraid of the hazard?" "Not me," said Abel boldly. Mrs. Trefusis, seeing that her idea was beginning to work, followed up the advantage. "It is settled that you put your money together to make a home for her, whether you toss for her or leave it for her to choose?" "Yes," said Eric quickly, and Abel agreed with equal sturdiness. Mrs. Trefusis's little cunning eyes twinkled. She heard Sarah step in the yard and said, "Well, here she comes, and I leave it to her," and she went out. During her brief walk on the hillside, Sarah had been trying to make up her mind. She was feeling almost angry with both men for being the cause of her difficulty, and as she came into the room said shortly, "I want to have a word with you both. Come to the Flagstaff Rock, where we can be alone." She took her hat and went out of the house up the winding path to the steep rock crowned with a high flagstaff, where once the wrecker's fire basket used to burn. This was the rock which formed the northern jaw of the little harbour. There was only room on the path for two abreast, and it marked the state of things pretty well when, by a sort of implied arrangement, Sarah went first and the two men followed, walking abreast and keeping step. By this time, each man's heart was boiling with jealousy. When they came to the top of the rock, Sarah stood against the flagstaff and the two young men stood opposite her. She had chosen her position with knowledge and intention, for there was no room for anyone to stand beside her. They were all silent for a while, then Sarah began to laugh and said, "I promised the both of you to give you an answer today. I've been thinking and thinking and thinking till I began to get angry with you both for plaguing me so. And even now I don't seem any nearer than ever I was to making up my mind." Eric said suddenly, "Let us toss for it, lass." Sarah showed no indignation whatever at the proposition. Her mother's eternal suggestion had schooled her to the acceptance of something of the kind, and her weak nature made it easy for her to grasp at any way out of the difficulty. She stood with downcast eyes, idly picking at the sleeve of her dress, seeming to have tacitly acquiesced in the proposal. Both men, instinctively realizing this, pulled each a coin from his pocket, spun it in the air, and dropped his other hand over the palm on which it lay. For a few seconds they remained thus, all silent. Then Abel, who was the more thoughtful of the men, spoke. "Sarah, is this good?" As he spoke, he removed the upper hand from the coin and placed the latter back in his pocket. Sarah was nettled. "Good or bad, it's good enough for me. Take it or leave it as you like," she said, to which he quickly replied, "Nay, lass, aught that concerns you is good enough for me. I did but think of you, lest you might have some pain or disappointment hereafter. If you love Eric better nor me, in God's name say so, and I think I'm man enough to stand inside. Likewise, if I'm the one, don't make us both miserable for life." Face to face with a difficulty, Sarah's weak nature proclaimed itself. She put her hands before her face and began to cry, saying, "It was my mother. She keeps telling me." The silence which followed was broken by Eric, who said hotly to Abel, "Let the lass alone, can't you? If she wants to choose this way, let her. It's good enough for me and for you too. She said it now. I must abide by it." Hereupon, Sarah turned upon him in sudden fury and cried, "Hold your tongue! What is it to you, at any rate?" And she resumed her crying. Eric was so flabbergasted that he had not a word to say, but stood looking particularly foolish, with his mouth open and his hands held out with the coin still between them. All was silent till Sarah, taking her hands from her face, laughed hysterically and said, "As you two can't make up your minds, I'm going home!" And she turned to go. "Stop!" said Abel, in an authoritative voice. "Eric, you hold the coin, and I'll cry. Now, before we settle it, let us clearly understand. The man who wins takes all the money that we both have got, brings it to Bristol, and ships on a voyage and trades with it.
Then he comes back, marries Sarah, and they two keep all, whatever there may be, as a result of the trading. Is this what we understand?
Yes, said Eric.
I'll marry him on my next birthday, said Sarah.
Having said it, the intolerably mercenary spirit of her action seemed to strike her, and impulsively she turned away with a bright blush.
Fire seemed to sparkle in the eyes of both men, said Eric.
A year so be. The man that wins is to have 1 year.
Toss! Cried Abel, and the coin spun in the air. Eric caught it, and again held it between his outstretched hands.
Heads! Cried Abel, a pallor sweeping over his face as he spoke.
As he leaned forward to look, Sarah leaned forward too, and their heads almost touched.
He could feel her hair blowing on his cheek, and it thrilled through him like fire. Eric lifted his upper hand. The coin lay with its head up. Abel stepped forward and took Sarah in his arms. With a curse, Eric hurled the coin far into the sea. Then he leaned against the flagstaff and scowled at the others, with his hands thrust deep into his pockets. Abel whispered wild words of passion and delight into Sarah's ears, and as she listened, she began to believe that fortune had rightly interpreted the wishes of her secret heart, and that she loved Abel best. Presently, Abel looked up and caught sight of Eric's face as the last ray of sunset struck it. The red light intensified the natural ruddiness of his complexion, and he looked as though he was steeped in blood. Abel did not mind his scowl, for, now that his own heart was at rest, he could feel unalloyed pity for his friend. He stepped over, meaning to comfort him, and held out his hand, saying,
"It was my chance, old lad. Don't grudge at me. I'll try to make Sarah a happy woman, and you shall be a brother to us both."
"Brother be damned!" was all the answer Eric made, as he turned away. When he had gone a few steps down the rocky path, he turned and came back. Standing before Abel and Sarah, who had their arms round each other, he said, "You have a year. Make the most of it. And be sure you're in time to claim your wife. Be back to have your banns up in time to be married on the 11th of April. If you're not, I tell you, well, you shall have my banns up, and you may get back too late."
"What do you mean, Eric? You're mad!"
"No more mad than you are, Abel the Henna. You go, that's your chance. I stay, that's mine. I don't mean to let the grass grow under my feet. Sarah cared no more for you than for me 5 minutes ago, and she may come back to that 5 minutes after you're gone. You won by a point only. The game may change."
"The game won't change," said Abel shortly. "Sarah, you'll be true to me. You won't marry till I return."
"For a year," added Eric quickly. "That's the bargain."
"I promise for the year," said Sarah. A dark look came over April's face, and he was about to speak, but he mastered himself and smiled.
"I mustn't be too hard or get angry tonight. Come, Eric, we played and fought together. I won fairly. I played fairy all the game of our wooing. You know that as well as I do. And now, when I'm going away, I shall look to my old and true comrade to help me when I'm gone."
"I'll help you none," said Eric, "so help me God."
"It was God help me," said Abel simply.
"Then let him go on helping you," said Eric angrily. "The devil is good enough for me."
And without another word, he rushed down the steep path and disappeared behind the rocks. When he had gone, Abel hoped for some tender passage with Sarah. But the first remark she made chilled him. "How lonely it all seems without Eric." And this note sounded till he had left her at home, and after. Early on the next morning, Abel heard a noise at his door, and on going out saw Eric walking rapidly away. A small canvas bag full of gold and silver lay on the threshold. On a small slip of paper pinned to it was written, "Take the money and go. I stay. God for you, the devil for me. Remember the 11th of April. Eric Samson." That afternoon, Abel went off to Bristol, and a week later sailed on the Star of the Sea bound for Pahang. His money, including that which had been Eric's, was on board in the shape of a venture of cheap toys. He had been advised by a shrewd old mariner of Bristol whom he knew, and who knew the ways of the Chersonese, who predicted that every penny invested would be returned with a shilling to boot. As the year wore on, Sarah became more and more disturbed in her mind. Eric was always at hand to make love to her in his own persistent, masterful manner, and to this she did not object. Only one letter came from Abel, to say that his venture had proved successful,
and that he had sent some £200 to the bank at Bristol, and was trading with £50 still remaining in goods for China, whither the Star of the Sea was bound, and whence she would return to Bristol. He suggested that Eric's share of the venture should be returned to him with his share of the profits. This proposition was treated with anger by Eric, and as simply childish by Sarah's mother. More than 6 months had since then elapsed, but no other letter had come, and Eric's hopes, which had been dashed down by the letter from Pahang, began to rise again. He perpetually assailed Sarah with an if. If Abel did not return, would she then marry him? If the 11th of April went by without Abel being in the port, would she give him over? If Abel had taken his fortune and married another girl on the head of it, would she marry him, Eric, as soon as the truth were known? And so on, in an endless variety of possibilities. The power of the strong will and the determined purpose over the woman's weaker nature became in time manifest. Sarah began to lose her faith in Abel, and to regard Eric as a possible husband. And a possible husband is, in a woman's eye, different to all other men. A new affection for him began to arise in her breast, and the daily familiarities of permitted courtship furthered the growing affection. Sarah began to regard Abel as rather a rock in the road of her life, and had it not been for her mother's constantly reminding her of the good fortune already laid by in the Bristol bank, she would have tried to have shut her eyes altogether to the fact of Abel's existence. The 11th of April was a Saturday, so that in order to have the marriage on that day, it would be necessary that the banns should be called on Sunday the 22nd of March. From the beginning of that month, Eric kept perpetually on the subject of Abel's absence, and his outspoken opinion that the latter was either dead or married began to become a reality to the woman's mind. As the first half of the month wore on, Eric became more jubilant, and after church on the 15th, he took Sarah for a walk to the Flagstaff Rock. There he asserted himself strongly. "I told Abel, and you too, that if he was not here to put up his banns in time for the 11th, I would put up mine for the 12th. Now, the time has come when I mean to do it. He hasn't kept his word." Here Sarah struck in out of her weakness and indecision. "He hasn't broken it yet!" Eric ground his teeth with anger. "If you mean to stick up for him," he said as he smote his hand savagely on the flagstaff, which sent forth a shivering murmur, "well and good. I'll keep my part of the bargain. On Sunday, I shall give notice of the banns, and you can deny them in the church if you will. If Abel is in Pencastle on the 11th, he can have them cancelled and his own put up. But till then, I take my course, and woe to anyone who stands in my way." With that, he flung himself down the rocky pathway, and Sarah could not but admire his Viking strength and spirit as, crossing the hill, he strode away along the cliffs towards Bude. During the week, no news was heard of Abel, and on Saturday, Eric gave notice of the banns of marriage between himself and Sarah Trefusis. The clergyman would have remonstrated with him, for although nothing formal had been told to the neighbours, it had been understood since Abel's departure that on his return he was to marry Sarah. But Eric would not discuss the question. "It is a painful subject, sir," he said with a firmness which the parson, who was a very young man, could not but be swayed by. "Surely there is nothing against Sarah or me. Why should there be any bones made about the matter?" The parson said no more, and on the next day he read out the banns for the first time amidst an audible buzz from the congregation. Sarah was present, contrary to custom, and though she blushed furiously, enjoyed her triumph over the other girls whose banns had not yet come. Before the week was over, she began to make her wedding dress. Eric used to come and look at her at work, and the sight thrilled through him. He used to say all sorts of pretty things to her at such times, and there were to both delicious moments of love-making. The banns were read a second time on the 29th, and Eric's hope grew more and more fixed, though there were to him moments of acute despair when he realised that the cup of happiness might be dashed from his lips at any moment, right up to the last. At such times he was full of passion, desperate and remorseless, and he ground his teeth and clenched his hands in a wild way, as though some taint of the old berserker fury of his ancestors still lingered in his blood. On the Thursday of that week, he looked in on Sarah and found her, amid a flood of sunshine, putting finishing touches to her white wedding gown. His own heart was full of gaiety, and the sight of the woman who was so soon to be his own, so occupied, filled him with a joy unspeakable, and he felt faint with languorous ecstasy.
Bending over, he kissed Sarah on the mouth, and then whispered in her rosy ear, "Your wedding dress, Sarah. And for me." As he drew back to admire her, she looked up saucily and said to him, "Perhaps not for you. There is more than a week yet for Abel." And then cried out in dismay, for with a wild gesture and a fierce oath, Eric dashed out of the house, banging the door behind him. The incident disturbed Sarah more than she could have thought possible, for it awoke all her fears and doubts and indecision afresh. She cried a little, and put by her dress, and to soothe herself, went out to sit for a while on the summit of the Flagstaff Rock. When she arrived, she found that there a little group anxiously discussing the weather. The sea was calm and the sun bright, but across the sea were strange lines of darkness and light, and close into shore the rocks were fringed with foam, which spread out in great white curves and circles as the current drifted. The wind had backed, and came in sharp, cold puffs. The blowhole, which ran under the Flagstaff Rock, from the rocky bay without to the harbour within, was booming at intervals, and the seagulls were screaming ceaselessly as they wheeled about the entrance of the port. "It looks bad," she heard an old fisherman say to the coastguard. "I seen it just like this once before when the East Indiaman, Coromandel, went to pieces in Desert Bay." Sarah did not wait to hear more. She was of a timid nature where danger was concerned, and could not bear to hear of wrecks and disasters. She went home and resumed the completion of her dress, secretly determined to appease Eric when she should meet him with a sweet apology, and to take the earliest opportunity of being even with him after her marriage. The old fisherman's weather prophecy was justified. That night at dusk, a wild storm came on. The sea rose and lashed the western coasts from Skye to Scilly, and left a tale of disaster everywhere. The sailors and fishermen of Pencastle all turned out on the rocks and cliffs and watched eagerly. Presently, by a flash of lightning, a ketch was seen drifting under only a jib about half a mile outside the port. All eyes and all glasses were concentrated on her, waiting for the next flash, and when it came a chorus went up that it was the lovely Alice, trading between Bristol and Penzance, and touching at all the little ports between. "God help them," said the harbour master, "for nothing in this world can save them when they are between Bude and Tidtagel and the wind on shore." The coastguards exerted themselves and, aided by brave hearts and willing hands, they brought the rocket apparatus onto the summit of the Flagstaff Rock. Then they burned blue lights so that those on board might see the harbour opening in case they could make any effort to reach it. They worked gallantly enough on board, but no skill or strength of man could avail. Before many minutes were over, the lovely Alice rushed to her doom on the great island rock that guarded the mouth of the port. The screams of those on board were faintly borne on the tempest as they flung themselves into the sea in a last chance for life. The blue lights were kept burning, and eager eyes peered into the depths of the waters in case any face could be seen, and ropes were held ready to fling out in aid. But never a face was seen, and the willing arms rested idle. Eric was there amongst his fellows. His old Icelandic origin was never more apparent than in that wild hour. He took a rope and shouted in the ear of the harbour master, "I shall go down on the rock over the seal cave. The tide is running up, and someone may drift in there." "Keep back, man," came the answer. "Are you mad? One slip on that rock, and you were lost. No man could keep his feet in the dark on such a place in such a tempest." "Not a bit," came the reply. "You remember how Abel Behenna saved me there on a night like this when my boat went on the Gull Rock? He dragged me up from the deep water in the seal cave, and now someone may drift in there again as I did." And he was gone into the darkness. The projecting rock hid the light on the Flagstaff Rock, but he knew his way too well to miss it. His boldness and sureness of foot standing to him, he shortly stood on the great round-topped rock cut away beneath by the action of the waves over the entrance of the seal cave, where the water was fathomless. There he stood in comparative safety, for the concave shape of the rock beat back the waves with their own force, and though the water below him seemed to boil like a seething cauldron, just beyond the spot there was a space of almost calm. The rock, too, seemed here to shut off the sound of the gale, and he listened as well as watched. as he stood there ready with his coil of rope poised to throw. He thought he heard below him, just beyond the whirl of the water, a faint, despairing cry. He echoed it with a shout that rang into the night. Then he waited for the flash of lightning, and as it passed flung his rope out into the darkness where he had seen a face rising through the swirl of the foam. The rope was caught, for he felt a pull on it, and he shouted again in his mighty voice, "Tie it round your waist, and I shall pull you up!" Then when he felt that it was fast, he moved along the rock to the far side of the sea cave, where the water was something stiller, and where he could get foothold secure enough to drag the rescued man on the overhanging rock. He began to pull, and shortly he knew from the rope taken in that the man he was now rescuing must soon be close to the top of the rock. He steadied himself for a moment, and drew a long breath, that he might at the next effort complete the rescue. He had just bent his back to the work when a flash of lightning revealed to the other, each to the other, the two men, the rescuer and the rescued. Eric Sanson and Abel Behenna were face to face, and none knew of the meeting save themselves and God. On the instant, a wave of passion swept through Eric's heart. All his hopes were shattered, and with the hatred of Cain his eyes looked out. He saw in the instant of recognition the joy in Abel's face that his was the hand to succour him, and this intensified his hate. Whilst the passion was on him, he started back, and the rope ran out between his hands. His moment of hate was followed by an impulse of his better manhood, but it was too late. Before he could recover himself, Abel, encumbered with the rope that should have aided him, was plunged with a despairing cry back into the darkness of the devouring sea. Then, feeling all the madness and the doom of Cain upon him, Eric rushed back over the rocks, heedless of the danger and eager only for one thing, to be amongst other people whose living noises would shut out that last cry which seemed to ring still in his ears. When he regained the Flagstaff Rock, the men surrounded him, and through the fury of the storm he heard the harbour master say, "We feared you were lost when we heard a cry. How white you are! Where is your rope? Was there anyone drifted in?" "No one," he shouted in answer, for he felt that he could never explain that he had let his old comrade slip back into the sea, and at the very place and under the very circumstances in which that comrade had saved his own life. He hoped by one bold lie to set the matter at rest for ever. There was no one to bear witness, and he should have to carry that still white face in his eyes and that despairing cry in his ears for evermore. At least none should know of it. "No one," he cried more loudly still. "I slipped on the rock. The rope fell into the sea." So saying, he left them, and, rushing down the steep path, gained his own cottage and locked himself within. The remainder of that night he passed, lying on his bed, dressed and motionless, staring upwards, and seeming to see through the darkness a pale face gleaming wet in the lightning, with its glad recognition turning to ghastly despair, and to hear a cry which never ceased to echo in his soul. In the morning the storm was over, and all was smiling again, except that the sea was still boisterous with its unspent fury. Great pieces of wreck drifted into the port, and the sea around the island rock was strewn with others. Two bodies also drifted into the harbour, one the master of the wrecked ketch, the other a strange seaman whom no one knew. Sarah saw nothing of Eric till the evening, and then he only looked in for a minute. He did not come into the house, but simply put his head in through the open window. "Well, Sarah," he called out in a loud voice, though to her it did not ring truly, "is the wedding dress done? Sunday week, mind! Sunday week!" Sarah was glad to have the reconciliation so easy, but, womanlike, when she saw the storm was over and her own fears groundless, she at once repeated the cause of offence. "Sunday, so be it," she said without looking up, "if Abel isn't there on Saturday." Then she looked up saucily, though her heart was full of fear of another outburst on the part of her impetuous lover. But the window was empty. Eric had taken himself off, and with a pout she resumed her work. She saw Eric no more till Sunday afternoon,
after the banns had been called the third time, when he came up to her before all the people with an air of proprietorship, which half pleased and half annoyed her. "Not yet, mister," she said, pushing him away as the other girls giggled. "Wait till Sunday next, if you please, day after Saturday," she added, looking at him saucily. The girls giggled again, and the young men guffawed. They thought it was the snub that touched him so that he became as white as a sheet as he turned away. But Sarah, who knew more than they did, laughed, for she saw triumph through the spasm of pain that overspread his face. The week passed uneventfully. However, a Saturday, June 9, Sarah had occasional moments of anxiety, and as to Eric, he went about at night time like a man possessed. He restrained himself when others were by, but now and again he went down amongst the rocks and caves and shouted aloud. This seemed to relieve him somewhat, and he was better able to restrain himself for some time after. All Saturday he stayed in his own house and never left it. As he was to be married on the morrow, the neighbours thought it was shyness on his part, and did not trouble or notice him. Only once was he disturbed, and that was when the chief boatman came to him and sat down, and after a pause said, "Eric, I was over in Bristol yesterday. I was in the ropemaker's, getting a coil to replace the one you lost the night of the storm, and there I saw Michael Heavens of this place, who was a salesman there. He told me that Abel Behenna had come home the week here last on the Star of the Sea from Canton, and he had lodged a sight of money in the Bristol Bank in the name of Sarah Behenna. He told Michael so himself, and that he had taken passage on the lovely Alice to Pencastle. Bear up, man," for Eric had with a groan dropped his head on his knees, with his face between his hands. "He was your old comrade, I know, but we couldn't help him. Must have gone down with the rest that awful night. I thought I'd better tell you, lest it might come some other way, and you might keep Sarah Trefusis from being frightened. They were good friends once, and women take these things to heart. Would not do to let her be pained with such a thing on her wedding day." Then he rose and went away, leaving Eric still sitting disconsolately with his head on his knees. "Poor fellow," murmured the chief boatman to himself. "Takes it to heart. Well, well, right enough. They were true comrades once, and Abel saved him." The afternoon of that day, when the children had left school, they strayed as usual on half-holidays along the quay and the paths by the cliffs. Presently, some of them came running in a state of great excitement to the harbour, where a few men were unloading a coal ketch, and a great many were superintending the operation. One of the children called out, "There was a porpoise in the harbour mouth! We saw it come through the blowhole! Had a long tail, and it was deep under the water!" "It was no porpoise," said another. "It was a seal! It had a long tail! It came out of the seal cave!" The other children bore various testimony, but on two points they were unanimous. It, whatever it was, had come through the blowhole deep under the water, and had a long, thin tail. A tail so long that they could not see the end of it. There was much unmerciful chaffing of the children by the men on this point, but as it was evident that they had seen something, quite a number of persons, young and old, male and female, went along the high paths on either side of the harbour mouth to catch a glimpse of this new addition to the fauna of the sea, a long-tailed porpoise or seal. The tide was now coming in. There was a slight breeze, and the surface of the water was rippled, so that it was only at moments that anyone could see clearly into the deep water. After a spell of watching, a woman called out that she saw something moving up the channel, just below where she was standing. There was a stampede to the spot, but by the time the crowd had gathered the breeze had freshened, and it was impossible to see with any distinctness below the surface of the water. On being questioned, the woman described what she had seen, but in such an incoherent way that the whole thing was put down as an effective imagination. Had it not been for the children's report, she would not have been credited at all. Her semi-hysterical statement that what she saw was like a pig with the entrails out was only thought of anything by the old coast guard, who shook his head but did not make any remark. For the remainder of the daylight, this man was seen always on the bank, looking into the water, but always with disappointment manifest on his face. Eric arose early on the next morning. He had not slept all night, and it was a relief to him to move about in the light. He shaved himself with a hand that did not tremble, and dressed himself in his wedding clothes. There was a haggard look on his face, and he seemed as though he had grown years older in the last few days. Still, there was a wild, uneasy light of triumph in his eyes, and he kept murmuring to himself over and over again. "This is my wedding day. Abel cannot play more now, living or dead, living or dead, living or dead." He sat in his armchair, waiting with an uncanny quietness for the church hour to arrive. When the bell began to ring, he arose and passed out of his house, closing the door behind him. He looked at the river and saw the tide had just turned. In the church he sat with Sarah and her mother, holding Sarah's hand tightly in his all the time, as though he feared to lose her. When the service was over, they stood up together and were married in the presence of the entire congregation, for no one left the church. Both made the responses clearly, Eric's being even on the defiant side. When the wedding was over, Sarah took her husband's arm, and they walked away together, the boys and younger girls being cuffed by their elders into a decorous behaviour, for they would fain have followed close behind their heels. The way from the church led down to the back of Eric's cottage, a narrow passage being between it and that of his next neighbour. When the bridal couple had passed through this, the remainder of the congregation, who had followed them at a little distance, were startled by a long, shrill scream from the bride. They rushed through the passage and found her on the bank with wild eyes, pointing to the riverbed opposite Eric Sanson's door. The falling tide had deposited there the body of Abel Behenna, stark upon the broken rocks. The rope trailing from its waist had been twisted by the current round the mooring post, and had held it back while the tide had ebbed away from it. The right elbow had fallen in a chink in the rock, leaving the hand outstretched towards Sarah. With the open palm upward as though it were extended to receive hers, the pale drooping fingers opened to the clasp. All that happened afterwards was never quite known to Sarah Sanson. Whenever she would try to recollect, there would become a buzzing in her ears, and a dimness in her eyes, and all would pass away. The only thing that she could remember of it all, and this she never forgot, was Eric's breathing heavily, with his face whiter than that of the dead man, as he muttered under his breath, "Devil's help! Devil's faith! Devil's price!" The end. End of The Coming of Abel Behenna. Recording by Kate McKenzie, Zurich, Switzerland.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.